in weak in content, because she certainly was able to sing that song and say so much about what we're going to be talking about today. As a Wampanoag tribal leader told us about the cruelties imposed on her people by early colonists in the Plymouth and Massachusetts Bay Colony a couple of weeks ago in this room, I fidgeted in my chair with distress. I questioned in my mind what responsibility I have today for what our ancestors did. While none of my forefathers came on the Mayflower or any of the ships soon thereafter, they did come and settle someplace else. And where they settled, there were similar cruelties exacted on the indigenous population. King Philip's War in the 1670s in Massachusetts, when the indigenous tribes tried to hold off the colonists and failed, was not the end of dealing with the indigenous population. It was just the start. For the rest of American history until today, the land swindle of the native populations is still taking place. Land appropriation is the name of the game. Recently, the Onondaga Nation brought a case against the U.S. government at the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights for not upholding its treaty of 1794 that guaranteed the nation 2.5 million acres of land in central New York State. By taking their case to an international forum, the Onondaga Nation hopes to highlight the colonial nature of the relationship they live under and its effect on their civil rights, while understanding that their ancestral lands will never be returned. The commission's findings may bring some meaningful recommendations for restitution. Having been reared in Western New York State, I was familiar with the Irondequoit Confederacy and the names of all six member nations, the Onondagas, the Senecas, the Mohawks, the Oneidas, and the Cayugas, and the Tuscaroras. Our civics classes taught us some of their history, particularly the democratic nature of their association and their mutual defense agreements. However, nothing was taught on how the early colonists were land speculators, first and foremost. I remember being taught that George Washington was a surveyor and pushed up into Pennsylvania during the time of the French and Indian War, delineating land parcels. But I didn't think when I was young that the land wasn't his to survey. The doctrine of discovery was not a part of my civics class. Pope Alexander VI's demarcation bull of 1493 made sure that Columbus's discovery of the New World recognized that these lands belong to the Christian inhabitants, the Christian sovereigns whose flags were planted on its soil. As it said, any land not inhabited by Christians was available to be discovered, claimed, and exploited by Christian rulers. In 1792, Thomas Jefferson asserted that the doctrine of discovery was international law and therefore applied to the new nation. The letter of instruction from George Washington to Major General John Sullivan in 1779 tells how this doctrine was applied pretty much throughout America. It was a three-part strategy. First, kill or displace as many indigenes as possible. Two, negotiate a treaty. And then three, take the land. Washington's instructions illustrate the first part of the strategy very well. He wrote to Sullivan, the Major General, General John Sullivan, "You are appointed to command is to be directed against the hostile tribes of the Six Nation of Indians, with their associates and adherents. The immediate object are the total destruction and devastation of their settlements and the capture of as many prisoners of every age and sex as possible. It'll be essential to ruin their crops now in the ground and prevent their planting more." The genocidal command of Washington was news to me, and I'm sure it's news to everyone here. But it fit a pattern to diminish the native population as much as possible, and then sign a peace treaty. Numerous treaties were negotiated between the colonists and the Iroquois Nation Confederacy. But it was the 1794 Treaty of Canandaigua, which the Onondagas are talking about, that confirmed peace with signatures of chiefs of each of the six nations, and at the bottom of the treaty, George Washington. The last part of the strategy was a land grab. Various investors were interested in buying the land from the tribes. For the Irondequoit Confederacy land, the most famous was Robert Morris. We probably have heard about him in our history books, who was at the time the richest man in the colonies living in Philadelphia. Seeing an opportunity with the Seneca Nation, what is now Western New York State, to purchase most of their land there, Morris delegated his sons to go to the Genesee River near the present-day town of Geneseo to negotiate and sign a treaty. Others who were there for a month were the Six Nations, the leaders of the Six Nations, and representatives of the governments of Massachusetts, New York, and Washington, the federal government. The Holland Land Company also sent representatives. This company was soon to buy from Morris, who had paid $100,000 on paper to the Seneca tribe. The money was invested in shares of the Bank of the United States to be paid out to the Senecas in annual earnings of about $6,000 a year. The Treaty of Big Tree, signed in 1797, relinquished the rights of the Senecas of nearly all their traditional land, nearly 3.5 million acres, for a yearly annuity. If money was to be made on this deal, it would be the surveying and selling of the land west of the Genesee River to Lake Erie by the Holland Land Company. This is where my ancestors come in. My maternal ancestors, Jacob Scheimer and Clement Dunkelberg, were farmers in what is now Germany. They were lured to Pennsylvania in the late 17th and 18th centuries. Religious strife in Central Europe and the prospects of good farmland in the New World, promoted by William Penn, drew Protestant farmers to cross the ocean to Philadelphia and the land nearby. William Penn was a Quaker in England who was given land in the New World by King Charles II. Penn didn't think the king had the right to give him any land, it wasn't his, and that the land really belonged to the Lenape Nation, the indigenous people of the area. When he came to his colony in 1681, he intended to set up a holy experiment based on Quaker belief. I've come to respect the Quakers a lot doing my research. The main features of this experiment were a fair treatment of the indigenous people, no military, and a new approach to governance, including freedom of religion, an enlightened penal code, work for everyone, education for boys and girls, a widened franchise, and to start town planning to promote a healthy environment, which was, and Philadelphia, I don't know how the environment is now, but I'm sure in his day it was much better. In 1682, in Shagamoxum, some people may know this area better than I, on the Delaware River near Philadelphia, Penn made an agreement with the Lenape Nation. Legend has it that Penn promised to live with the Lenape in openness and love, and is one flesh in one blood. The Lenape, chief of the Lenape Nation, said to have replied, "We will live in love with William Penn and his children, as long as the creeks and rivers run, and while the sun, moon, and stars endure." However, after Penn's death, his two sons, who retained the charter from the king, were not as honorable as their father. They claimed from a supposed earlier agreement with the Lenape Nation that the tribe promised to sell them a tract of land starting at the junction of the Delaware and Lehigh Rivers and extending west as far as a man would walk in a day and a half. The Penn brothers, through their land agents, had already sold the land in the region before any of the Lapa natives had vacated it. The infamous Walking Treaty of 1737 was to clear the land of Lenape and to open it up for the sales to European settlers. The Lenape leaders assessed that it was really only around 40 miles that could be walked by man in 1.5 days. However, the secretary of the colony found three of the fastest runners and made a path that would go as fast as possible, and they were able to take over land the size of Rhode Island to give over to the Penn brothers. The Lenape had to move west. The Scheimers, my ancestors and Dunkelbergs, fresh from Germany, settled on this stolen land, the traditional land of the Lenape Nation. 100 years later, the second and third sons of those ancestors in Pennsylvania, those men that were not given their father's land to farm, had to move west to find land for their own homestead. News of cheap land being sold by the Holland Land Company in western New York State lured many of the Pennsylvania Deutsch to Niagara County. It was about the time the Erie Canal was being built and there was possibility of other types of employment. This generation of Scheimers and Dunkelbergs moved their families and possessions in Conestoga wagons from Scheimerville in Pennsylvania to acres of land demarcated by the Holland Land Company around a new settlement to be eventually named Lockport. Some of you may know Lockport. Once again, my ancestors paid for land swindled from the indigenes. Now it was from the Senecas. 300 years later from the first land swindle on the Delaware River, I bought a house on the bluff of the Herring Creek in West Falmouth. Surely a likely site for a longhouse of the Wampanoags many years ago. The land may have been taken from the Wampanoag after King Philip's War or later as parcels were sold to new settlers from England. Whether long ago or just yesterday, the dispossession of land from the indigenous population is the hallmark of how America was developed. Justice for the land claims of the Wampanoag or the Lenape, or the Senecas, or the Onondagas may never be adjudicated in their favor, but their original ownership can never be denied. The question mark is, could it have been different? If the Quaker values of William Penn's holy experiment were internalized by the settler population, maybe today the indigenous population would have a seat at the table, and our country would be a very different place. But the history of colonization has been pretty much the same all over the world. The colonizers subjugate the indigenous population. While we may not like to think about that, our forefathers are not so different from the French or Belgium and British colonizers, and maybe even in Africa, they were. And what of us? We are the inheritors of this stolen legacy. It's a hard legacy to face. My mother was very proud of her German farmer heritage, and she instilled it in me and my siblings. Many of us here have similar heritages of ancestors building a nation, of which we are very proud. New England is known for its pride in the Plymouth colony and the Massachusetts Bay colony. The song, "This Land Is Your Land, This Man Did My Land," epitomizes this pride. How do we acknowledge our heritage and also accept those facts that so contradict it? This is the conundrum that faces America when confronted with a history of conflict with the indigenous population. We are fortunate to have the LINK program address this conundrum in our sanctuary each month. As we listen to our Wampanoag neighbors, we learn more about what our ancestors did. It is important to know the sins of our fathers. But we need to do much more. First, I suggest we need to listen, to hear, and to try to understand. This meeting house sits on the ancestral, unceded, and occupied land of the Wampanoag Nation. How do we wrestle with this fact and our own deed of ownership? How do we acknowledge this fact? Reverend David, I remember one time he did so on an occasion in the past in the meeting house. And at monthly lectures at the meeting house, the Link program, the head of the Link program acknowledges that we are sitting on original land of the Wampanoag. As we as a congregation, we may wish to think about how we acknowledge our land tenure. Acknowledgement will be hollow, however, if we don't follow up with a meaningful association with the Wampanoags. Dottie Shrump, I don't think Dottie's here today, and a few other members have formed a close association with the Wampanoag for some time, and the Link partnership with UU Falmouth has been established thanks to Joanne Treisman and others. These members have provided us with a path to the Wampanoag Nation that I think we should walk down as an organization. We can get to know them as neighbors and friends. We can listen to them. We can learn from them. Once we get to know them and they get to know us, we can find ways to support each other. Maybe they can teach us how we can live on this land better and be better caretakers. While we can't change history, we can learn from it and make decisions in the future to rectify the harm we have caused. Maybe it's so.
Now is the time for